Alan Kring Productions presents the Illinois State Collegiate Compendium, Academic Lectures in Business and Economics. This is Business Finance, FIL 240, Section 5 for Autumn Semester 2018. Lecture 13, delivered on October 2, 2018. The title of this lecture is Interest Rates.
Today, interest rates. As you see here in this chart, the dynamic yield curve, do you see how it's rising? It's lifting upward. And then do you see how it flattened there at the end? Look how it was lifting, and then it flattens. That's the Federal Reserve and the markets simply raising interest rates. Interest rates are going up across the board from the short to the long end. See how these treasuries there, even these very short-term ones, are going up? The intermediates are rising. Everything is going up. Interest rates are going up. That in itself is going to slow down the economy. And then at the very end here, notice this little pop right here flattens right out. That is a very sick yield curve, but it's not an inverted yield curve yet. As a matter of fact, there's a rumor that the Fed is actually trying to keep the yield curve from inverting by causing interest rates to stay higher on tens and sevens through open market operations. Whether that's true or not, I've seen some evidence, and it looks like the Fed is actually trying to actively keep the yield curve from inverting by keeping the 10-year rate above the 7-year rate by selling more 10 years, which drives their prices down faster than 7 years. So by driving the price of 10-year treasuries down faster, they keep the rate, the yield on the 10 years, above rate on the 7 years. Now, principle of finance. Got to get this one out here. I've shown it to you before. Ma'am, I need to borrow money from you. I'll give you back $100 in a year. How much will you lend me right now? What? Woman? You're not going to lend me any money? Oh, yeah, sure. Don't you hate it when you have a smart investor? Ma'am, if I gave you $100 in a year, you would lend me something less than $100 now. It's called discount. You would sell on a discount basis. Let's say that you would lend me, now I'm reputable, $97.50 right now, and I'd pay you back $100 in a year, okay? Now, what that means is that you would earn $2.50 on a $97.50 investment. The yield there would be 2.56%. Now, I come to you again in a year. I say, can we do that same deal in a year? I'll pay you back $100. And you say, sure, but I'm going to give you only $95 this time. Lady, what the heck? Okay, fine, whatever. So in the second round, you're going to do $95, and I'll pay you back $100. So this time you're going to earn $5 on a $95 investment. That's a yield of 5.26%. See what happens when the price of a debt goes down? The yield goes up. It's not even a finance principle. This is a math principle. Prices are inversely related to yields. In every area of finance, prices are inversely related to yields. Now, let me ask you, sir, I think you should invest in Google stock, okay?
So let me go G-O-O-G. Goog.
There you go, $1,200 a share. So you're going to pick up a round lot, you know, pull some change out of your pocket. Okay, well, good news. Google went up, what the heck? Whoa, it went up almost $5 today. Well, gol darn, you really did well today, didn't you? No, you didn't. The price is extraordinarily high, so that price up of almost $5, $4.80, is trivial. Trivial. However, you hear that the company Sears, actually achieved a long-sought goal. It became a penny stock last week. I know, you know. I call them, you know, bruh. You know, there you go. A penny stock is what anything below a dollar a share. Well, Sears. Baskin and Robbins isn't a crime, man. I mean, their lemon custard was to die for. You get that lemon custard and.
I ate an orange leaf this weekend. It was pretty tasty, but she kept fussing because I used a whole can of whipped cream on. And then, anyway, SHLD.
Yeah! 81 cents. 81 and a half cents. There's your damn investment right there. I know, right? If... Well, what's funny is back in the day when I was doing investing, I'd have these people who thought they were genius investors, and they would, have you ever heard of something called the NASDAQ? Yeah. Well, there's where you buy cheap stocks. I mean, why would anyone go to that thing called the New York Stock Exchange when you can buy I found a stock for 25 cents there. You know.
Dude,
this is why Darwin is right. But I want you to imagine this. If this son of a dog went up by $4.80, oh, you see the idea there? Lower means higher expected return, though, on a given dollar increase. This is that same principle in play. Of course, you get the higher risk, much higher risk in something like this, but higher risk, higher expected return. $4.80 on Google is meaningless. $4.80 on Sears means you go there and buy a Craftsman tool set on your capital gain. Except they sold their Craftsman stuff. But you see, that same principle is in play. Yeah, go ahead.
Out of curiosity, can you go to the max? Go for what do you need?
The max.
Maximum?
Yeah.
Oh, well, let's go back.
Ouch.
down the ring of fire.
Let me go out to the back. That was 5 years. Oh, look. Holy.
Well, there's your damn buy right there. That was a buy signal. You see the declining tops? I told you about declining tops. Those are declining tops from hell. But notice something interesting here. Remember I told you about a neckline? Do you see that neckline that formed right there and it failed on the neckline? That was actually a sell signal right there. It failed on the neckline. It was trying to reach its neckline, never made it. To that neckline, it had gone up so fast, so hard, in the early 2000s, and then it failed to break the neckline here. See how it tried, failed, third fail? That is when you sell. That was a classic elf move. Yeah. I don't want to. I mean,
did you look at it?
Yes. What? Okay, let me explain something. Tesla actually went up. This is proof. Well, it's gone up. See how it went way down here and now it's risen again?
So the idea of being sued is enticing to investors.
No, that's because some investors use crack cocaine. I mean, the problem is that Tesla is one of those things that we call anomaly. That's a fancy word for what the F. But notice something interesting with Tesla. Do you see that it had these declining tops and it broke the neckline here? That was why the L's started buying, is it broke a downstroking neckline on the tops. See those downstroking tops right there? And then it broke it. And that was where the buy signal was for the technical. Elves are the ones who do these charts. Now, whether or not what they're doing is actually works, we know it's being done out there. And it's sort of like you may or may not believe in Thor. But if the Vikings are coming at you waving giant hammers and, Thor lives, well, you believe in it long enough to defeat them. So that's why, whether or not technical analysis is meaningful or not, you can see that the markets actually use that kind of logic. And so whether or not it's you know, academically okay, I had to live in the real world where you had people who were cray-cray. And you have to adapt to what they'll do because they've got a lot of money and they can drive markets sometimes. Go.
Do you think it went up a little bit because you designed an
experiment? Go to the
5-minute. I'm afraid to. That was where they set a trap that they thought Musk would walk into and die. Do you see that? Look at that. I mean, I don't think I've ever seen that happen before. I've been in this world of finance for decades, and I don't think I've ever seen that happen.
That's the whole of the trap muscle.
And it didn't work. The son of a bitch is still twitching. And then he keeps publishing these weird pictures of his dreams of science fiction and all that kind of stuff. The problem is that he is not unusual. You have seen, are any of you familiar with Howard Hughes? He was a famous aviator. As a matter of fact, there was a movie made of him called Aviator. Leonardo DiCaprio did an incredible job of playing the part of Howard Hughes, one of the incredible innovators of aviation in the 20th century. And Howard Hughes was also one of the craziest, most mentally ill men you would ever want to read about. I mean, he was completely, I mean, wow, he was insane. He'd go through periods where he'd lock himself in a room for months and months and he wouldn't leave. And there was no bathroom in the room. That gives you an idea of how, and they did it, how DiCaprio managed to pull that off as well as he did. But anyway. Okay, I'm not going to do that anymore. See, that's like, showing you that's like, it's like showing, you know, kids who are curious about things like that and taking them and letting them watch a Stormy Daniels movie. Yes, you should know about this someday, but not today. Oh God, it's in the news again today. Sometimes I wonder if I should put a nanny service on the internet. You're not allowed. People in my class are not allowed to look at finance websites without parental guidance. Oh, that's weird. Okay, let me explain. Interest rates all start with some base. There is something underneath all interest rates. Now, when I say the interest rate, there is no such thing as the interest rate. There are interest rates on home mortgages, interest rates on corporate AAA bonds, interest rate on a junk bond, interest rate on a car loan, interest rate on this, that, and the other thing. And the coupon rate on a debt instrument that was issued by Panama was 4.5%. The coupon rate on a debt issued by Ghana last year was 19.5%. What the hell is that kind of a difference when Ghana is not that much worse off than Panama? But the problem is, of course, there's much more interest in Panama. China, Saudi Arabia, and Russia are just pouring money in there because we're not there anymore, and that's a strategic choke point for the 21st century, just like it was in the 20th century, and we walked away. Now, who's interested in West Africa? Hardly anyone right now, but that'll change. And as more investors come in, that will mean that there will be more demand for the debt instruments of these West African economies. Demand pushes prices up, yields go down. And that's the whole idea of helping these countries out, as we're trying to do by teaching their finance ministry people some modern finance methods. Attract capital. The more demand for your debt there is, the higher the price of the debt is, the lower the yield is, and therefore the better you can manage your debt situation and your interest payments. Now, every interest rate starts with a substrate, with a basic interest rate that is underneath every interest rate. This interest rate is called the risk-free rate, but it has two internal pieces to it. There is a real rate of return. This is driven by the supply and demand dynamics of money. As the demand for money goes out, the real interest rate goes up. As the Fed prints money, the supply goes out and interest rates go down. This is the big one. Supply one goes to supply two. So the real rate goes from R1 down to R2. That's how our Fed fuels the economy. It increases the supply of money in the economy by buying treasuries from banks and giving the banks real cash money for it, which drives interest rates down, or by selling treasuries to the banks, which drives the prices of them down and interest rates up. That's the real rate of return.
Wait, so if demand goes down,
prices go down, interest rates go up. But if you're thinking about that, if our government is desperately borrowing money at a rate we have never seen in the history of almost any, we've never seen it in the history of any nation. Right now, we are borrowing money at a rate that is unbelievable. It's staggering. And so, of course, that means that we are selling treasury bills to the open market from our government, laying them out on the table and say, please buy them. As the supply of those goes up, the prices go down, which drives the yields on treasury bills upward, like that. So the government essentially effectively crowds out capital that would be available to private markets because it's offering whatever interest rate it has to attract the capital so that it can pay its bills, because it does not have even close to enough money through tax revenues anymore to pay the bills. I would recommend, now they still have a few seats on that spaceship that's, you know, Musk, is it Musk who said he's going to send, yeah.
So there's a good economic standing in Marx.
If they get a McDonald's and a Whataburger and maybe a White Castle. That's the real interest rate. There's another piece here that's in this. Now, understand that the two pieces here we can't see. They combine to create this, which itself we can't really see. We can see something very close to it. But the other one is expected inflation, which we designate with a pi superscript E. Expected inflation premium. Now, when I say expected, I want to make sure you understand that that is not the inflation rate that you would hear in the news. This is the one that is coming up next,
not the one that has already happened.
It's the one that the market expects. Now, madam, I have decided that I'm going to hire you. I have my own business, you know, and I've decided you graduated from college, you need a full-time job, and you come to me and I say, well, okay, I'll hire you. And I will pay you well full-time, $100 a week, right? I mean, I'm just that kind of guy. $100 a week. Don't give me that. Sounds like the dog next door. Okay, $100 a week. Okay. Well, you work for a year. I'm impressed. Well, you come in for your annual review, and I say, well, did a damn fine job this year. Now, inflation ran this past year 2%, so I'm going to give you a 2% increase. I'll get back to work. Okay, well, obviously I didn't give you any merit. I didn't give you anything on top of this, but I did correct for inflation, right? Now, you come in the next year, and I say, well, you're still doing a great job. Now, inflation this year was running 4%, so I'm going to give you a 4% raise this year. Get back to work. Next year, you come in. Well, you've been doing a great job. Inflation this year has been running, this past year ran 6%, so I'll give you a 6% raise this year. Now, eventually, you're going to say, now, let's stop right here, fat boy. There's a problem with what I've been doing. Do you see the fundamental? Never mind the merit. I wasn't paying her any merit, but let's talk about the inflation, the cost of living adjustment. What's wrong with what I've been doing? It takes a minute, but I'm teaching you how we think in finance. It's not beating. You're losing because 2% already happened when I raised her 2%. 4% had already happened when I raised her 4%. 6% had already happened when I gave you 6%. You're not being compensated. You're being cheated. Do you see why? Because the inflation rate that I'm giving you, instead of giving you 6%, what would you say? No, I don't want 6%. What do you want?
Not $100 a week.
Well, no, you want 8%. You want what is about to happen, not what's already happened. Because if I give you 6%, you've already taken the 6% hit through the year. Do you see that? You need what is expected to come. That's how markets work. We are not going to price based upon what has already happened. We are going to price based upon what is we expect to happen next. You, sir, you were in a relationship with a wonderful lady for 25 years. It was just a great, every night you come home. And the two of you laugh and you dance together to your favorite song. You are so beautiful to me. And it's just been wonderful. The lights are on every night and you come in. This one night you come in and it's quiet. It's raining out. It's almost raining. There's lightning. And the house is dark. And the thunder rolls. You open the door and it's pitch black in there. Honey, I'm home. She comes out with an automatic, an AR-15. Brrr, 25 rounds, she unloads. You dive into the car running, screaming, crying, and you drive away. And you drive and the rain is coming down and the thunder rolls. And that song, it's playing on the radio. You are so beautiful to me. Can't you see? Tears are running down your face. Are you going to go back there? I mean, that was really only one incident. 25 bullets, 25 years. That's only one bullet a year, man.
No.
But then the music, you're everything I hope for. You're everything I need. Some of you are like, God, that makes it stop. But you understand the point, though. It's not what has already happened. It's what you expect to happen next. You go back there, you expect she's going to pop a cap in your ass. I got a headache on this temple right here. You understand that we cannot care about what has already happened. We cannot care about the past because the future will destroy us if we are looking backward that way. You go with me on recon. I put you on point, okay? You're going along and you're looking back. Everything is safe back there. That's when you trip over the claymore. Whoop! Guys, boom! And we find you in the Ville next to a couple of clicks up the road. Okay, part of you anyway. You see, that's what we're trying to get you to understand in finance. In logic, in business, we can't live in the past. Companies do this sometimes. They'll live on their past merits, their past laurels. Sears was the ingenious inventor of online sales in the 1800s. They were the company that made themselves famous by the Sears catalog. Who should have dominated the era of the internet? It should have been Sears. They knew how to do it. From a century and a half of experience, they knew how to do it. But they lived on, well, we're Sears. We don't give a crap anymore. The same happens to so many companies. Nikon, they lived off the Nikon name, and now their cameras are crap. The same is true of a lot of other companies. They live off their past laurels, and then the future eats them alive. JCPenney did the same, is facing the same fate. So this is why financial markets never, ever look back in time. They always look forward. The problem is that that can create a nightmare for those who want the past to disappear in a way, because we form our expectations of the future from our past experiences. Madam, you have lied to me so many times. Every time we're together, it's just another lie. Go on now, go. Walk out the door. You get along now. You're not welcome anymore. I should make a song out of that. I have all my life to give. You understand, though, we can't live in the past. And the problem is that, especially if the government just keeps telling you the same lie over and over again, sooner or later, the markets don't believe you anymore. If a company keeps misleading you about its products or about its prospects and its sales, you can't believe it anymore. If an employee, and you're going to face this, the employee swears to God it was just a one-time thing, and I swear I won't do this again. Eventually, you know damn well they will. Back in the 1950s, we had a Democrat and then a Republican, Truman and then Eisenhower. They were classic, both of them, in different parties, but they were both old school, very moderate. Neither of them was really interested in going crazy with tax cuts too much or with lots of social programs. They tried to stay more middle of the road. And Eisenhower, he didn't have spectacular growth of the economy, but he had very stable growth. And he warned about too much active government. He warned about too much active no government. He was right in the middle, as Truman had been before him. And then we got into the 1960s, and we had a much more aggressive president, Jack Kennedy. He believed in government. He believed in the power of the government to lead us into a new age where we were facing enemies that were governments, not corporations, they were governments. The Soviet Union was a bloc that was communism. And the only way to face that was to start to get the government involved in a more aggressive way. Well, he said, let's the government pay for space exploration. Government pay for more aggressive measures in Southeast Asia, where the Chinese and the Russians are beginning to influence elections and influence political and military events. And then he was killed. He was shot in Dallas in '63. And his vice president, Lyndon Johnson, took over. Now, Lyndon Johnson was a much, much more conservative blue dog Democrat from Texas. Old joke was that Johnson came out to be the president, which means he had to put his white hood and sheet away. But interestingly enough, he embraced Jack Kennedy's policies, and they became what was known as guns and butter. We put guns and boots on the ground in Vietnam, and we just bomb the hell out of everything we can see in the North until the communists get tired of interfering where we have an interest. And at home, we engage a war on poverty. We stop just pretending that it's not something that we could try to fix. Guns and butter meant more money needed. And of course, that meant, well, not really taxes. Taxes had been high for, ever since there'd been an income tax. The marginal tax rate on rich people was 90%. So that wasn't the issue. The issue was we needed more money other ways. And one of the ways was, of course, the Fed could print money, just print money. Okay? Well, you print money, money supply goes up, rental rate on money goes down. Interest rates dropped. We had a very active economy. We were fighting in Nam. We were also building the projects in Chicago and all that. By the time we got near toward the end of Johnson and into the next president, Richard Nixon, there was a problem beginning to show itself just a tiny bit. You see, because the only way that inflation can start is if there's more money being printed than the economy can use. It wasn't much of a problem because we had a lot of latency, and so money could be printed at a pretty darn aggressive rate, and it wouldn't show up in inflation right away. Our real expected inflation and this risk-free rate, which is the baseline rate of all rates. So in the late 60s, you might have a real interest rate of, let's say, 2.0%. And no one expect, and financial markets, they hadn't seen inflation in many years. I mean, the last serious inflation was had been right after World War II, when the Fed printed tons of money to pay off the war bonds. But since then, there was very little expected inflation. Maybe about, and I'm just pulling a couple of numbers out here, 0.5%. So you probably had a risk-free rate that was a nice, tame 2.5%, something like that. This would have been in the 60s, late 60s. But Johnson didn't run for office again because the Vietnam War had, he was very aggressive in pursuing it, got very unpopular. We had a couple of really nasty events with protesters your age getting shot to death for protesting against getting drafted. And so Richard Nixon came in 68, and he was reelected in 72, and a problem happened very quickly in his late second administration. The OPEC oil embargo happened. We pissed off the Arabs real bad because they had attacked Israel. Israel wiped them out, just blew them out of the water. And the Arabs said, now, wait a minute, that little country couldn't have done that on its own. Oh, it's you, United States. You want our oil, but you are supporting our enemy. And so the Arabs cut off the oil supply. And that made oil, I mean, it was just awful at the time. There were lines, cars waiting for gasoline literally for miles and miles. I was there, I remember seeing it. It was just terrible. And prices of gasoline couldn't go up enough because Nixon put up a price ceiling on gas prices, which created, of course, an even worse situation because you had a classic economic shortage. Well, the economy started going into a tailspin. So the Fed, to help it, printed a bunch of money, which brought the real interest rate down. Supply of money goes up, price of money goes down. And inflation stayed pretty calm. And the economy tried to do okay, but then it began to show up as expected inflation. If first inflation showed up, And then the expectation that it would continue showed up. So the Fed was holding a lower interest rate, and then inflation began to rear its head, and expected inflation started to show up. The Fed wanted the economy to stay moving, so the Fed started printing money at a more aggressive rate, brought the real rate down. So, and at first, that worked. The risk-free rate went down, but then, once the markets figured out that this was just phony money, the expected inflation rate began to increase. The Fed swore to God it was going to stop printing extra money, but it didn't. It printed more money to bring interest rates down, and very quickly, the markets reacted. And they started reacting harder and harder because there was a liquidity overhang beginning to occur. Nixon resigned in 1974, and his vice president, Gerald R. Ford, took over. Ford was a real classic, old-fashioned, moderate Republican, really a nice guy, kind of a goofy guy. He had a reputation for being clumsy, but he was a pleasant guy, but he didn't know how to stop what seemed to be starting to happen. The Fed was literally pouring money into the economy to get interest rates to go down enough to correct for inflation expectations rising. But the inflation expectations were beginning to rise pretty aggressively by this time. Ford had just hundreds of thousands of these little buttons printed he wanted people to wear. Whip inflation now. Win, he called it. In other words, just say no to inflation. If you're a company, just say no to raising your prices. If you're a worker, just say no to a wage increase. Whip inflation now. Stop this. Well, of course, it doesn't work that way. This is a physical process that's going on. And the Fed was running out of room. It could print huge amounts of money, and there was very little more that could come out of that, that law of diminishing marginal return. The more you do something, the less you get out of the last thing that you do. So the Fed was getting down to the point where there was hardly any more room to move, and yet expected inflation was beginning to skyrocket because the markets were realizing there is this massive liquidity overhang that's been building for over a decade. And so we began to see inflation rates, expected inflation, going through the roof. And that drove up interest rates in general all through the economy, which was beginning to drag the economy down. No matter what the Fed did to try to bring the real rate down, the expected inflation premium was pushing upward and up more and more. And no matter what the Fed promised, said, oh, we're going to fight inflation, everyone knew they were lying. They were going to have to just keep printing money, trying to stop a recession from building. Well, Ford lost in 1976, and he was replaced by Jimmy Carter. Jimmy Carter was a peanut farmer, but he was also a nuclear physicist. He actually understood what was going on underneath this. He knew. But he didn't have the courage to do what had to be done at first. He started out like Ford did. We're going to give our fight against inflation a name. He called it the moral equivalent of war. Meow. Of course, the media just ate the poor son of a bitch alive for that one. But he did. Yeah. Now, Carter, he's still alive. He was a very religious man, very nice man. He works. He's like in his 90s, and he still builds houses for Habitat for Humanity. but he knew what had to be done, and he finally got the courage to do it. The problem was that the expectation of inflation had already embedded. He appointed a new chairman for the Federal Reserve, a man named Paul Volcker. Paul Volcker is one of those people, he's still alive, who was one of the meanest, most unsympathetic sons of bitches you'd ever want to meet. He's called Tall Paul. He's a very tall man. He smoked cigars, and he'd blow the cigar smoke in your face. And Volcker said, "We're going to crush the money supply." And, of course, no one believed him. They'd been hearing that all along. That's that thing I was talking about. They did not believe Paul Volcker was for real. Volcker crushed the money supply. Supply goes down. The price of money goes back up. He shot that money supplies rate up over a period of weeks. But the markets didn't believe him. They were just building more and more of an expected inflation premium, which meant that the risk-free rate was skyrocketing. By the time Volcker had crushed the money supply down to the point where the real rate of return was in excess probably of about 7%, expected inflation was still raging upward because everyone knew Volcker was lying. No one's going to stop this. So the risk-free rate was going through the roof. You had mortgage loan rates 25, 30%. Corporate bonds, the coupons were running 30%. Some of those just expired, the 30 years just expired in 2010. Well, of course, what that did was that sent us into a spiraling recession. Right during election 1980. Carter went up against a Hollywood actor who'd done westerns, and he'd done cigarette commercials and westerns, and he had a folksy kind of conservative, real hardcore conservative, doing a couple of things that Nixon had done with the dog whistling to the southern wing of the party, and he just creamed. Carter was just kicked in the ass in the election, lost. And Reagan came in. Now, Reagan helped the matter by he and the Congress passed a heavy tax cut, which helped the economy out. And by this time, the markets were beginning to think, wait, Volcker might be serious. You see, if I've got my hand on your throat, at first you're not going to believe me. I'm a nice guy. You know me, right? I said, do you believe me? Okay, do you believe? Do you believe me? No. See, at first they didn't believe him. But it was only after your eyes start bulging, and I keep saying this. You see, by the time we get to 1982, the expected inflation premium was still high. Volcker had not convinced the markets of how serious he was. The economy was really suffering. And Volcker just kept his hand on the throat of the economy. Even when the market still said, no, you don't mean what you're saying. You're not going to do a thing. But eventually, you're starting to black out. Finally, the markets realized Volcker is not kidding. Volcker finally asked, do you believe me now? One more question. Well, who's your daddy? You are. And the expected inflation premium began to fall. Volcker didn't let up on the money supply, though, for about a year after that. He wanted to make absolutely sure that there wasn't one dime of excess liquidity in the economy. So eventually, though, the real interest rate went down, expected inflation went down, and we had a pretty darn good run up until about 1990 or so, and then the economy did. Then there was some money, too much money was printed because there was a market crash during George H.W. Bush's administration, and so the Fed had to crush the money supply again, going right into the election in 1992. And George H.W. Bush was beaten by a young pup out of Arkansas named Bill Clinton. But that is why we have to watch the Fed. You see me talk about the Fed all the time. And a lot of the finance textbooks don't even bother. They don't want to talk about it. It's as if we don't want to talk about this thing out there that drives markets. Well, it's done it before, and it's going to do it again, and you're right in the middle of it. But as I've said before, the recession is coming and the stock market crash. That's, you know, your problem. You might want to go over there and talk to those people at the internship fair. Lock something in before the economy goes to hell. That's all I have for you tonight. Thank you.